As the silent seconds dance in their eternity about me and set aflame again the fire to inspire my nimble fingers to procure the pen and awaken it in a resurrection, transforming the ink to the blood of the writer. As once again he bleeds his acquired wisdom like a light into the world.
Good morning, Carbro and the Big Chill. This is Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else, coming at you from WCOM 103.5 FM. I'm here in the studio with my co-host, John Paul.
Good morning. Say hello to How come you didn't tell me to say good morning, John Paul?
I don't know. I think I've heard you say it too often.
Usually you tell me to say good morning, John Paul.
But I'm going to ask you
to turn dutifully up. Can you obey?
I'm having some trouble with my headset.
Once again. Claudio shows he's technically challenged. He's having difficulty turning up his knob.
Watch what you're saying. Say good morning, John Paul.
Good morning, John Paul.
There we go. We finally got it out of his system. We're here in the studio today, and I have the privilege of having Judd Patterson with us, whom I will reveal to you a little later, but he's, suffice it to say for now that he is an ex-tech guy turned entrepreneur, and wait until you hear the entrepreneurial skills that he does have, as well as connections to the old rock and roll scene and album covers and such. We'll get into that in just a few moments.
Say good morning, Judd.
Good morning, Judd.
Yeah.
There we go.
It's all right.
Tradition. Shall I say good morning, Claudio, then? Is that,
yes.
Is that where we are this
say
morning?
Good morning, Claudio.
Hello, Claudio. Where are you? Who are you? Who am I? I want to acknowledge very quickly the Carolina Theatre of Durham, one of our underwriters, and give a quick rundown of what's coming up there. On February 3rd, we have, which was tomorrow, Arts Discovery on Screen. February 1, it's referred to, but it's on the 3rd. Then on the 7th, the NCSU Sikh Student Association presents Virsu Punjab Da. On February 9th, Arts Power National Touring Theatre presents Fish Face, which I think is a children's production. And then on the 13th, the one I'm looking forward to, the Carolina Theatre presents Ladysmith Black Mambazo.
Which that ought to be really good.
Wonderful act, yeah. And then on the February 13th, Carolina Theatre presents Refro Phantasma Film Series, the Nevermore Fundraiser, which is a triple feature. On the 14th, Carolina Theatre presents Arlo Guthrie's Lost World Tour, which I am stage managing, so I can't wait to meet Arlo. We've actually met him once before when you and I were performing at the Rialto in Raleigh.
Is that the solo reunion tour?
That was last year.
Oh, that was last year.
That's when my car blew up. I had the stage manager gig, and my car blew a head gasket. Yeah. And I was more down about not meeting Guthrie than I was my car blowing up.
I'm sure.
And then on the 17th, the Carolina Theatre presents Guitar Blues with Jorma Kokkonen, Robin Ford, and Ruthie Foster. On the 20th, 21st, and 22nd, Carolina Theatre presents the Nevermore Film Festival, which is always a big event. On the 25th, American Theatre of Arts for Youth presents Wizard of Oz. And then we have the, on February 28th, the Cat's Cradle presents An Evening with Joan Baez. She's still making it happen.
I'll be darned.
On March 2nd, Carolina Theatre presents Arts Discovery Series, Seussical the Musical. March 4th, we have American Theatre Arts for Youth presents Black Journey. March 5th, we have Carolina Theatre presents David Sanborn, another one I'm looking forward to. March 6th, Carolina Theatre presents The Art of Belly Dance, featuring the belly dance superstars.
Hey, we ought to be good at that, with the bellies and everything.
How is your navel, darling?
A lot of beer drinking for training.
Yeah, a lot of beer drinking makes for good belly dancing.
I have a funny feeling there'll be some beer drinkers watching over there. On March 7th, we have Carolina Theatre presents An Evening with Judy Collins, whom I didn't even realize was still doing performances.
Excellent. Yeah, that's right. She's recently started getting more,
back on the scene?
Public limelight. Yeah.
I love her stuff, so I'm looking forward to that one. March 10th, the day before my birthday. Hey, Arts Discovery on Screen, Durham, a self-portrait of Durham. March 10th, we have the Carolina Theatre and AC Entertainment presenting Annie DeFranco. She was here last year. March 13th, Carolina Theatre presents Arts Discovery Series, Miss Bindergarten Gets Ready for Kindergarten. I think that's a kid's show. Carolina Theatre presents on March 13th, Pieces of War starring Kenny Carnes. March 14th, Dance Educators of America. March 15th, Chamber Orchestra of the Triangle. March 20th, Refro Phantasma Film Series. March 21st, Arrogance. March 26th through 29th, Durham Savoyards present The Gondoliers. They do something there annually. On April 2 to 5, Full Frame Documentary Film Festival. April 8th, we have American Theatre Arts for Youth presents Cinderella. April 11th, Carolina Theatre presents Boney James, who is there quite frequently. And then on April 14th, we have Arts Discovery on Screen presents The Guest Worker. April 17th, Duke Divinity School presents Broadway Review 2009. April 17th, Carolina Theatre presents Refro Phantasma Film Series. They keep reoccurring. April 18th, we have Mahogany Dime Awards. April 19th, Carolina Theatre presents San Jose Tycho. April 20th, Arts Power National Touring Theatre presents Four Score and 7 Years Ago. And, nearing to a close here, April 25th and 26th, we have the North Carolina Youth Tap Ensemble, which is truly worth your while. I've worked that a few times, it's a great show. April 27th, Carolina Theatre presents Arts Discovery Series Super Scientific Circus. And then on the 29th, which is as far as we go for the present, Carolina Theatre presents Chris Botti. Is it pronounced Botti or Botti? B-O-T-T-I. Do you know?
I have no idea.
Well, Chris Botti, anyway. And that's the word for the Carolina Theatre of Durham. Also want to thank John Demers for Studio in the Woods and wonder what's going on there. You need to keep me updated, Jonathan. Hope you're doing well. And at this point, I'm going to float in the direction of Judd Patterson.
I was just going to give a shout-out to the Carolina Theatre myself.
Ah, please do.
We went to see Vicki Lawrence there Saturday night. And it was just a fantastic show all around. It was she came out and did some Vicki Lawrence stuff and then went off and came back as Mama.
Aha, and how was she as Mama this late in the game?
Oh, she was great.
I'm sure. Did she have to put much makeup on anymore for playing Mama?
Oh, I don't think. Just the wig and the glasses and the dress, you know.
I remember Ira David Wood saying the older he gets, the easier it is to play Scrooge. He doesn't even doesn't need makeup anymore.
Yeah.
Sorry, Ira David Wood. I know you didn't want that kind of a shout-out, but hey.
Too late.
We give it all up at the speakeasy. Anyway, when I jump over here to Judd, and I'm pretty much going to let you take the lead on this interview, since Judd and I had the pleasure of meeting at the cocktail hour over at Temple Theater by way of Peggy Taphorn.
Right.
And I'm hoping their fundraising is really sort of pulling things together at this point.
I think they're being pretty successful. They've got, I guess you could call it a theme called One Strong Woman, and they have these events and their fundraisers. They've got a fundraiser coming up Valentine's Day.
Oh, good. Okay. What is One Strong Woman?
Well, it's just women getting together and bringing some money. They might have a particularly, I don't know, energetic person who leads the group.
Mm-hmm.
I know that March the 1st, Jen Chapin. Harry Chapin's daughter.
Actually, Peggy's friends with.
She's going to come and do a show on March the 1st.
Wonderful.
And that's going to be a benefit concert, too, you know, to raise money for the Temple Theater. So
I may have to try and make that one.
I believe that the fundraising efforts are paying off, and good. I think the Temple's going to be fine.
At some point, good. Peggy, you're certainly welcome on the show again to catch people up. I know you have a pretty good, strong Chapel Hill audience base, and I think some of them listen to the show, so come and tune us in. Keep us abreast. Anyway, again, the Temple Theater in Sanford still needs local support. I think Peggy's doing the best she can, but I don't know that the money's drifting in fast enough, so every little bit counts.
It does, and it's not just Lee County that needs to support the Temple Theater. The surrounding counties, they have some awesome productions.
Yes.
And it's a fun night out. There's some nice restaurants in Sanford. You can go take in a meal and a show and you know, kind of get away from the hustle and bustle of the RTP area.
Mm-hmm.
And
just for historical purposes, the Temple Theater is actually a former vaudeville house, much like the Carolina Theater of Durham, so it has a lot of character in that regard and is certainly a historic site worthy of preservation.
Well, it looks like we just got back on the internet, so we should say hello to the World Wide Web.
Hello, World
audience.
Wide Web, and anyone
hello,
catching
Wide
us live streaming.
Hopefully there are people out there who are listening.
Well, I think ArtSync magazine usually has folks tuning in, and who
yes.
knows who's scrutinizing us at this point.
Yes. Well, fortunately, they can now actually hear us.
The black coats haven't come to the door yet and told us to leave.
No, but we're expecting them any moment.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, so I'm going to bounce over to you and let you introduce the many God, avenues
the many
you
faces
walk.
Of Judd.
This is Judd Patterson, folks.
Well, I came to this area in 1981. I actually drove into Raleigh, North Carolina on Christmas
from
Day.
Where? From where?
From Hattiesburg, Mississippi.
Oh, boy.
Having just completed my master's degree in computer science, I took a job with IBM.
And you just got off a paddle wheeler before coming.
That's right. And it was the manager that hired me at IBM said, you know, if you come between Christmas and New Year's and start your job, your first anniversary with IBM will be January 1st. So I came, worked for 4 days, and had 2 weeks of vacation.
That is a heck of a deal.
Where can I get a job like that?
That was a good deal.
I want me a job like that.
Well, they actually equalized that later on and made it kind of fair for all the people that didn't get to take advantage of that.
Ah.
But so I did. I packed up my little Mercury Capri. I was newly married, came to North Carolina, drove into Raleigh on Christmas Day, 1981. Snow on the road, looking for the hotel that we were staying in, and started my job. Hmm. And
your job was exactly?
I was a software developer. I have a degree in computer science, a master's degree in computer science from the University of Southern Mississippi. My undergraduate degree is in psychology. I went to Ole Miss from 72 to 76. I have a degree in psychology with a minor, and minors in music and chemistry.
Oh, wow. Boy, that's an interesting combination. Yeah. How'd you dig that up?
So I tell people that in high school I was voted most versatile. So I had to fulfill that obligation, and therefore I became versatile.
I think most of us use that as a survival tool in some degree.
Yeah, that's true. But after I graduated from Ole Miss, at first I thought I wanted to go into graduate school in music. And in order to get out of college, I took all the psychology classes I could because they were fairly easy, I thought. And
I had a bent for it, I would imagine.
Yeah, and it was a quick way to get my bachelor's degree so that I could hurry into graduate school for music. Well, it turned out I really liked psychology. And I thought maybe I would go into clinical psychology. So I applied to all these graduate programs, and I didn't get in any of them. So I thought, well, I'll work in the field for a few years, mm-hmm. beef up my GRE scores, because that was part of the reason I didn't get in. They weren't so great. So I worked for 3 years in psychology. I was called a group leader in this private psychiatric hospital for about a year. Some really interesting stories there.
I imagine.
And then I took a job with the state at the state mental hospital in Whitfield, Mississippi, as a psychology technician. Our job.
And explain that. That sounds like an interesting variant.
It was a very cool job, really. We administered psychological tests such as the Wechsler Adult Intelligence Scale, the WACE, they called it, the MMPI, the Rorschach Ink Blot Test. And
you were the guy behind the lever making those little zzzz.
I didn't do any of that. I actually did participate in a few shock treatments, though, in the private psychiatric hospital, which the first one I observed, I fainted.
Ouch.
Ouch.
And, what were they testing you for?
Oh, they weren't testing me.
He was testing.
He was
shock treatments. You're talking about electroshock
therapy.
Those are actual treatments, not tests.
I see. All right.
Yeah, these were.
Sorry, I never used one.
Did you see One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Yes, I did, actually.
You remember?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't quite that brutal.
Yeah,
they do administer muscle relaxers and stuff like that. Anyway, ancient history.
Mm-hmm.
So where was I? Anyway, for 3 years I did this work in the field of psychology, and the psychology technician job was very interesting in the fact that...
How does that vary from the actual just psychology itself? The technician, aspect, meaning...
The technician basically administers the tests...
Mm-hmm.
Creates summaries, and then the chief psychologist actually looks at the data and interprets it.
Gotcha.
So we were kind of like, maybe an electrician's helper. We would create the conduits, but then the electrician has to come in and do
mm-hmm.
the real
right.
stuff.
Gotcha.
So after 3 years of that, I said, you know, I don't think I want to do this the rest of my life.
I can imagine.
And I started pursuing different areas of interest, and it turns out that the last semester I was at Ole Miss, I took a class in computer programming, and I started thinking, you know, that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that, and I applied to a graduate program at the University of Southern Mississippi in computer science, and I got in. I had to make up some undergraduate prerequisites, but over the course of a little over 2 years, I earned a master's degree in computer science. And, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s, computer science and computer programming was the rage. I mean, if you knew how to do that, getting a job was no issue. It was just, where do you want to work?
Wasn't much public access, but I imagine the corporate was pretty intensely involved.
Yeah, I mean, this was before PCs. And so anyway, I ended up coming to IBM. And it was about that time that the PC, you know, the first PCs had two diskette drives. There was no such thing as a hard drive for a PC.
Ah, right.
And anyway, I started my career with IBM, had a lot of interesting projects, got to travel, went to England, went to Palo Alto, California, got involved heavily in the telecommunications part of software development. And I ended up spending 4 years in Japan with IBM. So that's probably one of the highlights of my life is living in Japan for 4 years, learning the language, living a different culture. It gives you a real appreciation for, you know, and Japan's a developed culture and very modern. But still, the culture is different. The language is different. The way of life is different.
And very traditional, too, I would imagine, in some respects.
In many ways. It's changing now. I've been back a few times since. But still, you know, the tradition's still there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it just gives you a completely different perspective on life and how to be tolerant and appreciate tolerance. Because you know, you're in their culture, so you're the one that needs to conform. You don't have to go around expecting them to speak English to you because, hey, I'm from an English-speaking country. Please conform to me.
This ain't your backyard. That's right.
So, anyway, I came back from Japan in 1989 and stayed with IBM another 4 years, during which time I developed personal computer software to teach you how to read and write Japanese characters because I learned quite a bit over there. And it was pretty revolutionary at the time. There's a lot of good stuff now that far surpasses what I did. But it was a fun exercise, and it kind of kept the language alive in my head developing that software. And I forgot to turn my...
His music box just came on. Hello, whoever's calling, you won't be getting an answer right now.
So I'll take care of that right now. But doing that increased my software skills, and then I guess around 93, things at IBM started changing a lot, and I was ready for a change myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to work at Nortel Networks, and what was to become Nortel. And still software development, but again, I worked in the Japan development group, and so I had trips back and forth to Japan again. But it was during this time that I was driving home one day, and I was listening to the radio, and Jim Cook from Boston Brewing, brews the Sam Adams
beer. Right, yes. It took a minute for
the
name to register.
You know, Jim Cook is to Boston Brewing as Dave Thomas was to Wendy's. He did his own commercials.
Haven't been in the pub for a while, but this is the speakeasy, so keep going.
So, he was talking about how Sam Adams beer is brewed only with the finest hops and noble hops. They cost 10 times more than regular hops. And I was listening to this, and I'm going, I wonder what a hop looks like. And I have a tendency to think in puns, and I started thinking, you know, what we could do is develop this container that looks like a hop, because I thought that a hop was sort of a cone-shaped herb, and it is. It looks like an artichoke kind of turned upside down and stretched a little bit. I thought we could develop a container that looks like a hop, put it on a bar to collect tips in, and we'll call it the bar hopper. So,
I like that.
It actually was an idea that stuck. I decided I was going to design this container, and I applied for a patent and actually got a patent on it. The patent attorney says, you know, Judd, you might put a bar hopper in every bar, but you could put a beer hopper in every hand. So the first implementation of this patent is actually a beer glass with an area for personalization. And they're all hand-pressed. We had a mold built in Wheeling, West Virginia.
When you say we.
We, me.
Yeah, okay, thank you. He became two people there.
That's right, yeah. Well, that's from the old schizophrenic days in psychology.
There we go.
But
we understand.
Yeah. It takes a multiple personality to come up with an idea like that and really implement it.
It helps in the arts in general.
So,
I mean, look at John Paul.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So actually had these glasses made, and I feel a sneeze coming on here, so.
Gesundheit, yeah. In advance. There we go. You've been given notice.
As I started getting these glasses made, and
this was just something you did off the cuff, yeah, sort of as a hobby, because you hadn't opened up your own business.
Right. Now, this was sort of the beginnings of it, though.
Right.
This is how it all...
And this is actually where our story is going, folks. He has a really fascinating career in the arts with designs that he speaks of, as well as album covers and so on, that we'll get into as the story progresses.
Right. We had the mold built, and there's a glass place in Cambridge, Ohio, that actually has what they call it a hand glass shop. It's basically small molds. They lob the glass into it. They pull this plunger down into the mold, and it squeezes the glass out to the shape. Mm-hmm. So that's how this glass was actually made. And I started marketing the glass and to home brewers, people who were into craft beer. And it was about this time that craft beer was really beginning to grow in the United States. Breweries were opening up everywhere. Microbreweries, and
mm-hmm. We are talking 90s here, right? Or
what year was this? Yeah, it was around 91, 92 is when this kind of started.
Yeah.
And actually, it was more like 96. Because,
yeah,
because
okay.
I had left IBM in 93, and then the patent actually issued in 1997.
He left IBM and went straight for a beer, folks.
Yeah. And I was paying a lady good money to etch people's initials onto these glasses that they would buy them. Mm-hmm. And she only had one font and one really sort of old-fashioned system for glass etching. And I started researching, how do you do glass etching? And it turns out that there was a guy in Cary, North Carolina, which is where I live in Apex, so mm-hmm. Next door.
Well, Cary tried to swallow up Apex, but Apex resisted.
Well, used to live in Apex. Now Apex is the size Cary was when I moved to Cary.
Right.
But it turns out that he was an expert in photoresist technology and materials for glass etching.
Hmm.
And in fact, he's the guy that's responsible for the, I don't know if you've seen the Korean War Memorial in Washington, but it's these photographic images etched onto granite slabs. He was responsible for all the stenciling for that.
Hmm.
Anyway, I started learning how to etch glass with, you know, any design that if I could print, I could etch it. And there's a material out there called photoresist that you print your vellum or your film, mm-hmm. you expose the photoresist to that, and then wash it out, similar to the way you do screen printing for charts. And so once I kind of mastered that and started collecting the equipment to do my own glass etching, then the number of things I could do just expanded, you know, exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
If I could etch a beer glass, I could etch a piece of crystal, a bowl, an award. And so I started on the side growing this little business of doing etched glass awards. I obtained a laser engraver so we could laser engrave plaques, wooden boxes. And then it became a matter of marketing. And how do you reach people that need what I do?
Absolutely. And, let me jump in here for a second.
Yeah.
ArtSync Magazine, I'm assuming some of you folks are tuning in. This might be something for you to consider as well, having Judd as a connection for when you give out magazine-oriented awards. Just put that in your back pocket.
And, in fact, we do a lot of corporate awards like that. And periodically, like we just did the North Carolina Technology Association every year has a set of awards called the 21 Awards, and there's different categories of corporate, responsibilities for which they give awards.
Mm-hmm. And, matter of fact, you have two of your designs in the studio today.
Right, and we just had some little bases made that light up, that shine through, some crystal awards, and, you know, if this were TV, we'd show you.
Yes, in the meantime.
Just hold it up to the microphone there. And
that's right.
That's
yeah,
what you can see.
We'll describe it really well.
Yes, that's right.
Maybe we'll get some pictures or something and get them out on the website. But
we can do that, yeah.
It just has taken on a life of its own.
And you actually began, when did you actually start your own business with this?
In 1997 is when I actually started the business. It's called Creative Concepts LLC. And
tell us where it is and how people can contact you.
We actually have a storefront now in Cary.
Mm-hmm. How long has that been up?
About a year. But really focusing on it in the last few months. We do have some retail in the front area, and then in the back is where we do all the glass etching.
Mm-hmm.
I ran the business from my home until it just took over my house. So it's a matter of I'm still moving stuff from the house to the business, but it is a commercial location now, and it's
give us the address.
It's 744 East Chatham Street, Suite L. It's if you're familiar with Cary and the old Circus Family Restaurant, it's across the street and near the back, just opposite the Employment Security Commission.
In that little shopping center,
right. Yeah.
Near the railroad tracks down there.
Right, not far from where Maynard and Chatham.
Yeah. That one-level shopping center.
That's it, brown,
no high-rises.
Brown and white.
Right.
Yeah. But there's a really, that's a cool shopping center. There's a lot of
it's been around for a long
ethnic
time.
Businesses down there, a big Indian population,
East Indian,
Mexican. There's even a European modeling agency just next door, and this guy's come from Las Vegas, and he knows what he's doing. He's worked with really famous people, and he's a cool guy.
Yeah.
So anyway,
give us your email, or do you have a website people can go to?
I've got a bunch of websites, and because I focus on niche areas, I find niches, and then I go after them, and it's amazing how much business there is out there, as long as you can focus. You know, people say, well, there couldn't be too much out there. Well, a little bit of a big number is still a big number.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of what I...
A whole lot bigger than nothing.
That's right. So there are a lot of pilots out there. There are a lot of people who own their own planes, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And what we... For example, one of the niches we do is we'll find people who are plane owners, and I have clip art of every kind of private airplane that you can imagine.
Hmm.
We might take their registration number, etch an image of their airplane on a martini glass, and they'll order a set of six martini glasses.
Oh,
well,
sure, yeah.
That's a nice little, you know, and it starts to spread. If somebody who owns a plane sees somebody else that's got something like that, say, where'd you get that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, it spreads.
I'm already thinking Seafarer's emblem at some point.
There you go. So, you know, this kind of...
So, website again. Do you have a universal website? Maybe.
Yeah, the universal one is, it's www.kkllc.com. That stands for Creative Concepts LLC.com. The actual name of my company is Creative Concepts, but it's Creative with a K, Concepts with a C.
Mm-hmm. So it's almost like a German Kreativ.
Yeah, but the domain name KCLLC was taken, so I had to go with the KKLLC.
Okay.
But you know, as I want to kind of move on to this rock and roll sort of connection, and
which we're all anticipating,
the really kind of fun side of the business. Not that the other stuff isn't fun, but it's the, you know, that's kind of the breadwinning.
Well,
part.
The biographical sketch always helps people to understand how you got there.
When I was in college and high school, I always tended toward the progressive rock music, like Yes and Genesis and King Crimson and Gentle Giant. And your friend Ernie, I think his favorite band was Gentle Giant.
Yeah, I believe so.
I mean, we were talking about the album covers and who did them. So,
and he did say hello, by the way.
That's,
you were on the show today. I think
Ernie,
he's probably tuning us in.
Well, hi, Ernie. And the Yes logo, I don't know if the listeners can visualize it, but it was a really curvy, kind of an ingenious piece of art, really.
Mm-hmm.
And
for the fact that it was three letters.
Right. And in the late 70s, and even the early 70s, throughout the 70s, Yes were just a huge band.
Yes.
And the guy that did their album cover art, his name is Roger Dean.
Mm-hmm.
And Roger Dean became so synonymous with Yes, and the album cover art became so much a part
became
of
a
Yes.
Became a signature, yeah. Very
yeah,
much so.
That Roger Dean has often been referred to as the sixth member of Yes. And even out of college, one of the first things I bought was a Roger Dean calendar. Little did I know, in 25 years, I would actually be working directly with Roger Dean. And the way that happened is
yeah, tell us that.
I wanted to etch that Yes logo onto a nice piece of glass. I thought it would be a cool product for people who were big Yes fans. And rather than just do it and sell it without permission, I wanted to do it the right way. So I looked at contacting Roger Dean, and I found a phone number in England, and I ended up calling it and speaking with this gentleman. And I was explaining what I wanted to do, and I thought, this is probably an agent for Roger, and I would, like to broach this with Roger himself. And the man on the other end was going, well, this sounds very interesting. I've never really had anybody ask me to do anything like this before. And I paused. I said, is this Roger? And he says, yeah. So I was a little taken aback.
It's a sneaky moment.
Yeah, it was one of those really cool moments. And,
yeah, no doubt.
So he said, well, why don't you send me a sample and let me see, what you're doing, and maybe we can work together. So I did. And we started working together on a variety of projects, some of which worked out, some of them didn't. But the fact that I had kind of developed this relationship with him, word got around to the community of people who are into progressive rock. And by the way, there's a really cool progressive rock festival that happens in Chapel Hill every year called Prog Day.
Ah, yes, yes, yes.
And they have it at Storybook Farm every year, right. Labor Day weekend. Bands from all over the world come to this. So out of Prog Day grew another progressive rock festival, which has become the premier progressive rock festival in the world. And it's in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania every year at Lehigh University. At the Zollner Arts Center. It's an indoor festival.
And you're saying this grew out of Prague?
It grew out of Prague Day,
in
Chapel Hill, because the people come from all over the United States to Prague Day. Well, these two guys that came...
And how was that picked up north?
Well, the two of the guys that came to Prague Day figured, hey, we need something like this up where we are.
I see. Okay.
And so they at one time considered moving Prague Day to Bethlehem.
Mm-hmm.
And the organizers down here really wanted to keep it here. So the guys up there decided, well, we'll have our own.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually call it NearFest. It stands for the Northeast Art Rock Festival.
I'll be darned, okay.
And the first year they had it in a small music hall at the Moravian College in Bethlehem. And they sold out 450 tickets, which they were glad they sold out. The next year they moved it to Zollner Arts Center at Lehigh. 1,000 seats, sold out almost immediately.
Wow.
And anyway, the guys that organized it kind of caught wind that, hey, Judd, we know Judd, he knows Roger Dean. Maybe we can ask him to ask Roger if he would come over. We'd pay for him to fly over. We would give him a space to do vending,
mm-hmm.
and he could do our logo for the year. So I asked Roger if he would do it, and he said, sure, I'll do it.
Wow. Not bad.
So it was, and bear in mind, at this point, I'd never met Roger in person. We'd only spoken on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was really anticipating this event coming up. Roger was going to be flying over, and we were going to be working together. So I'd ordered all of this merchandise from one of his publishers out in California called Pomegranate. He had books that he'd written in the 70s and 80s. The first book was called Views. And it was really a collection of architecture and album cover art that he had done up to that, maybe mm-hmm. 1975. And
I think you pointed out that his own background was in architecture.
It was and design.
Design, sorry.
Yeah. And but he had done by this time he'd done stage design for Yes. When mm-hmm. Yes were touring with huge props and stages, he and his brother Martin Dean actually did a lot of the stage design.
Yes, really. Continue to take on the influence that he put.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not just album covers, but the whole stage designs and these elaborate concoctions of things that would look like giant crabs that would swallow the drum kit and just really huge stage designs. And he just did a stage design for him recently that was a lot more scaled back, but still has that very Roger Dean look.
Mm-hmm.
And Roger comes. I go down to the hotel to pick him up. I've got all these posters and books and stuff that I'd gotten from Pomegranate. And I knew that this stuff would sell because the target market, his target market was all concentrated right there in the Zollner Arts Center for this mm-hmm. 2-day concert. He's a really nice guy, but he walks into the room and I thought he was going to have a heart attack. He said, oh my gosh, what are we going to do with all the leftover stuff? And I said, Roger, I said, it will be gone. He says, I'll make you a friendly wager. I said, okay. So it was just, I don't even think we had any monetary value on it. It was just kind of a gentleman's bet. By noon Sunday, the tables were bare, and he was just couldn't believe it. I said, well, first of all, you have to realize that the 1,000 people that are here, they're all your fan.
Yeah.
And you being here to sign their posters, you know, it's just icing on the cake. I mean, who wouldn't jump at the chance to buy a book and have it signed by you right here? So it was very successful. And, you know, again, the audience can't see this book, but
yes, we have two books in the studio.
There's a whole section on Nearfest in this most recent book that Roger published called
Dragon's Dream, right?
Yeah.
And then you have a second one. What is that?
This is a reissue of a book that he and Storm Thorgerson, who Storm was the guy who formed Hypnosis, which was the company that did most of the Pink Floyd album cover stuff.
Yes, yes. So it's the two of them, and the title of the book is called Album Cover Album.
And the original Album Cover Album was done as a paperback, but this is a hardback book, and it's got some new forewords and things like that. But it's
very much in the style of the large graphic art hardcovers.
So an interesting thing about the first book that Roger did called Views is that with hardly any promotion, it became an overnight bestseller. And the way this happened is, if you remember back in the 70s, we didn't have big like Tower Records and stuff like that. Everything was mom and pop shops, Bebop Records. Every town had their own album store. And this is before CDs.
Pity we've lost that.
Yeah. And so what they did was the book was made the same size as an album, of 12 inches square. And Yes was a big group at the time, so they just stuck the books right next to the albums. And when people went to buy their Yes album, they saw this book. Well, it was full of Yes album cover art and all the other stuff.
Yep.
Gotta have it.
Yeah.
So with hardly any marketing, this book
just flew
off the shelves. Yeah. So in the 80s, Roger also did a lot of the album cover art for Asia, which was kind of a super group of Yes, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, and
Fusion when the moment you said Asia,
So he had a book called Magnetic Storm, which was kind of a follow-on to Views, and this was in the mid-80s. So it's been over 25 years since Roger did a book, and this was a long time coming.
So all this is re-released in some respects.
Well, but there's a lot of new stuff.
With the new stuff, implemented.
And
none of it is lost in time. It's all pretty timeless art.
No, and if you look at the front of the cover of this book, the dragon that's on the front is actually, this is the cover for a CD that came out maybe 10 years ago called Us and Them. It was the symphonic Pink Floyd. It was the Pink Floyd music set orchestra.
Right.
So while Storm Thorgerson had done most of the Pink Floyd album cover art up till then, Roger actually did the one for Us and Them, the symphonic Pink Floyd.
That's pretty amazing that he would get in there like that. How did Thorgerson, how did the two of them collaborate?
Well, they're friends. I mean, they're good friends. And once I started working with Roger, I started working with other album cover artists too, and things that were interesting to me. For example, I tended to look for album covers that were sort of monochrome, like black and white, things that I could etch.
And what you did, let's pause for a moment and just go in that direction. What was it exactly that you did in regard to the cover albums or the album covers?
So what I did was, I'm a huge fan of Jethro Tull, the band Jethro Tull. And their second album is called Stand Up. And if you remember what that album cover looked like, it was really, the album cover itself was, the basis for the art was a woodblock print, a woodblock carving. And because it was a black and white kind of album cover with lots of fine lines, I was able to get an image of it and create a stencil. And I etched an image of the album cover onto like a 6-inch square white tile. So I reproduced the album cover onto a tile. And I was the beer hopper, actually, the beer hopper glass that, you know, kind of got all this started. It was really instrumental in having me meet some of these people, because Jethro Tull came through Raleigh several years ago, and I just did a stick figure. Now, if you know anything about Jethro Tull or Ian Anderson, the leader of the band, he plays flute, but in the old days, he tended to stand on one leg and prop his other foot like on the knee.
Yeah.
So he made this kind of unique.
It was sort of a traditional stance.
and dance, and he would be playing the flute with one standing on one leg. And so I did a stick figure of a guy just standing on one leg playing a flute, and I etched it onto this beer hopper. And a radio announcer in Raleigh at the time was going to do an interview with Ian Anderson before the show, and she gave him the beer hopper with his the stick figure and the date of the show. About 3 weeks after the tour, I got this really nice letter from Ian Anderson saying he was unpacking his clothes from the tour, and he found this really nice beer glass, and he wanted to thank me for it. He was going to pour a beer into it that very moment. So it was really a, kind of a nice letter.
Cool.
That set the stage for later meetings. When Tull came back through, I contacted him about setting up a meeting. I had some other merchandise ideas. And remembering the beer glass, he granted me the meeting. And showed him some stuff, and he was like, "Yeah, let's do some stuff together."
Fantastic.
So it kind of grew from there, and then I found this company in North Carolina that actually does weaving, and that can take photographs, pictures, album covers, and I actually had a 4 foot square blanket of the stand up album cover woven, and we have sold literally hundreds of these with hardly any marketing.
Wow.
I had an order from a guy from Italy yesterday for one of these. I mean, I sell them all over the world. And they're,
this is by internet, of course, I would imagine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Jethro Tull, the band management, put a link to the site onto the official Jethro Tull website. They offer it. So
fantastic.
When somebody goes to that piece of merchandise, it comes straight to my site, and they place the order.
Well, something tells me a few folks tuning in today will probably go look some of these things up. I know I'm going to.
Yeah.
So... the whole idea of doing album covers onto throw blankets became kind of a focal point for me because the first one had been successful.
Great thing to lay out at concerts with and just sort of have your little picnic blanket right
there.
Yeah,
that's right, yeah. And so your friend Ernie was talking about his favorite sort of prog rock band is Gentle Giant.
That's Ernie Hood of Radio In Vivo, who usually comes on Wednesdays.
And it turns out that... the guy that did the original Gentle Giant album cover, his name is George Underwood. He did a lot of album cover art for bands like Gentle Giant. He did The Fix. I don't know if you remember a band called The Fix, but
vaguely I do. But
T-Rex, did early T-Rex album covers, and he was a childhood friend of David Bowie, and he did some of the early David Bowie album covers. People don't know this, but. Ziggy Stardust, the first Space Oddity album cover, not the one we see here, but the original album cover, had some really cool art on it, all done by George Underwood. And the album Hunky Dory, which has the song Changes on it, which most people recognize as, you know, an early hit for David Bowie. Ch-ch-ch, you remember? Changes.
Right.
So, anyway, he... asked David Bowie if it would be okay if we did a throw blanket of the Hunky Dory album cover, which we did. And it's a full-color album cover. I mean, full color throw blanket. Ah. It's about 4 feet by 6 feet. And it was actually featured on David Bowie's website at one point. A friend of mine and I were holding it up, and we look almost like tiny people next to this throw blanket, the way the picture was taken. But it was really another successful product, and I still have a few of those left. They're a little more expensive because they're all full color. They're woven differently, but it's really a nice product. And then we did some of Roger Dean's stuff.
It's a great idea, folks out there. Just want to remind you, this is WCOM 103.5 FM, Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else. Coming at you from the local studio, I have John Paul here as my co-host.
Yeah, that's WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carborough.
Ah, a correction.
Thank
being
you very
scolded
much.
On my own show. And we have Judd Patterson in the
just
studio
to
with
clarify.
Us, who's revealing a pretty amazing background in the arts, especially with rock and roll. And it's back to you.
And we are on 103.5. Of course, if you're listening on the radio, you probably already know that.
That's right.
But
he's insisting on these repetitions.
But if you're on the web, you may not know that.
This is true. Anyone catching us live streaming? Hello. Back to you, Judd.
So where were we? We were talking about David Bowie album covers and George Underwood. I want to go back a moment to the Jethro Tull stand-up throw, because the guy that did that woodblock print His name is Jimmy Grashow, and James Grashow. He lives in Connecticut. I don't think he's ever met Ian Anderson in person, but somehow they got together on this woodblock, you know, 1969. This thing was done.
Wow. That's the year I came to the States.
Yeah, and I've spoken with him on several occasions. I actually sent him one of the throw blankets when we first started doing them, and because, again, I wanted to get permission to do these. It was not like we just ripped them off and started making them willy-nilly. So when he got his throw blanket and opened it, the postman was still there. And he was so excited. He said, he grabbed the postman. He said, "Look at this thing. Look at this blanket. This is an album cover that I designed in 1969. This was, you know, maybe 7 or 8 years ago."
That's wild.
And he was so excited about it because it was really well done. It's an awesome piece of merchandise. And everybody that gets them, they write me immediately when they get it. And they say, "It's even more beautiful than I could have imagined." And it really represents the album cover well when you consider that this woodblock carving done on a 12-inch square block of wood.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Grashow, actually, when I first started talking to him about this, he said, "You know, unfortunately, I've lost that woodblock. I don't know where it is."
Oh, wow.
And but people ask me a lot of times, you know, what's the significance? Because on Ian Anderson's hand on the thing, he's got 6 fingers. What's the secret, you know, code? And he says, "I made a mistake."
Yeah.
And I wasn't about to recarve that whole piece of wood.
Isn't it interesting how these things stand out?
That's right.
I imagine that piece of wood would be worth a lot of money right now.
Well, the nice ending to this story is that he was cleaning out his attic one day and he found it.
Oh, man.
And he calls me up. He says, "I found it. I found the wood block."
Oh, God.
And he says, "I'm going to ink it and press it on rice paper and send you a copy of it."
Fantastic.
And he did. And if you think that the throw blanket looks really detailed, the detail in this inked, you know, ink pressing of this woodblock print is phenomenal.
Wow. Have you done anything with that?
I've stored it away very safely. I did take it out one night. Ian Anderson did a solo show at the Carolina Theater in Durham.
Yeah.
About 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, he had an album called Rupee's Dance, and it's solo Ian Anderson stuff, but it's very kind of Jethro Tull-like stuff. And so he came, and anytime Ian comes around, I always get some backstage passes and some tickets to the show. And so I took this with me and kept it very, you know, closed up and safe. But when I went backstage, I showed it to Ian Anderson, and he was blown away at how much detail there was in this thing.
Wow. That must have been a rewarding moment altogether.
It was.
I know that was one of the shows I didn't end up working. I don't know where I was 3 years ago at that time, but that's definitely one I was curious about. I think they're fixing some internet stuff. So where do we take it from there? What's the more recent stuff you've been involved in?
Well, let's see. I guess getting back to Roger Dean, he kind of completed his run with Nearfest. The guys that kind of started Nearfest, they ran it for 10 years. Roger was involved in the last 8. And at the last Nearfest, they announced a change in ownership of Nearfest. They handed over control of the festival to 3 guys that had kind of been helping them all along anyway. And another guy that that does album cover art and had come as a vendor to a couple of the Nearfest.
Was there a reason for this move? Or just
I think, you know, the organizers had kind of taken it. It really is an incredible amount of work, and they both have jobs.
Okay.
So I think they had mentored these 3 guys to kind of groom them to take it over. And, you know, once they did, Roger felt like he had contributed heavily to it, but it was time for him to step back and let the new guys create their own identity.
Mm-hmm.
And so they chose Mark Wilkinson, who is he's done album cover art for a group called Marillion, a band called Judas Priest. You may have heard
of course, yes.
He did most of their album cover art, Iron Maiden.
Right.
And he's a really nice guy. He lives in England. He's got some friends over in the States, but he's familiar with Nearfest, having come a couple of times as a vendor. Super nice guy. So I think that the new leadership is going to have a new artist to kind of put his his own brand on it. And you know, Roger, let's face it, when you've got a group of 1,000 people, it's not the same 1,000 people that come every year, but there is a lot of overlap. So
sure. Yes.
After 8 years, you know, most people had kind of gotten used to Roger being there, and there wasn't a lot of new product.
It had been
sell.
Through a cycle, so to
right.
speak. Yeah.
So I doubt that Roger will come back this year, but I'll be up there because we've got the new book here that we'll take up
Good
there and sell.
That.
And
well, since we're on this particular wavelength, give us your address and contact information one more time.
Okay. The business address is 744 East Chatham Street.
The name?
That's in Cary. It's Creative Concepts, Creative with a K, Concepts with a C, LLC. Big sign at the back of the store. I mean, at the top of the storefront.
Easy to find.
No Easy doubt. To find. Yeah.
I'll be looking you up in the not too distant future. And the website again.
It's www.kkllc.com.
Wonderful. And John Paul, I know you've got your show coming up next. I want to give folks a little snippet as to what direction you're going in.
Yeah.
Give us the name
yeah,
of your show again.
Well, it's the John Paul Truth Quest and Variety Hour. And
it's anything you want with a baseball bat.
Yes, and I'll have Mickey Mills will be joining me today, who is a musician who's been around here for a very long time, plays steel drums and writes and has been a institution basically in the local music scene for a couple of decades at least. And we'll be also talking about Black History Week today. And that'll be at 11 o'clock or so, maybe a few minutes after 11, while we change over our show.
We might finish a few minutes early, so you can have some time for that. That's okay with me.
Well, so that's what's on the schedule for today. And, of course, I will be talking about the lies that you hear on the mainstream media to some extent or another.
The probably, unmedia content.
Yeah,
yes.
Probably not as much as I do when I'm on the show with by myself, but I'll be going over a few things that, you know, some blatant lies that were on radio and TV this past week.
Yeah, it doesn't really stop.
yeah. And I'll be trying to hold accountable the people who tell these lies and explain what the actual facts are that they're trying to hide in the public media.
Yeah, I'm sure. And of course, John Paul also points out all the resources where he gets his information, so you can look it up for yourself.
Right. And, of course, I constantly tell people, don't believe me. Go find out for yourself what's going on. I'm going to sort of point people in the direction that I understand, and they go find out for themselves. Don't trust me. I could be a complete idiot.
We're seeking out the couch potatoes that will actually get off the couch and do something about what's going
Indeed.
On.
Indeed.
Oh, good. So that's coming up. And again, John Paul will be archiving the show you're hearing today with, I think we're going to call it Creative Concepts with Judd Patterson. We'll just take it from there. That'll be the title.
Yeah, Creative Concepts with K's, right?
With K, yes.
K's and C's.
K's and C's. Okay, well, K and a C then.
That's it. K, Creative Concepts. Think Germanic.
Yes.
Kreativ. Of course, that would have an F at the end of it as opposed to a V. And no E. Creative Concepts with Judd Patterson will be archived whenever John Paul gets around to that.
We'll probably get that done today.
Wonderful. And I think that pretty much covers it. Judd, is there anything you wanted to say?
Well, I guess in closing, you mentioned Arlo Guthrie earlier.
Yes, whom I'm looking forward to stage managing.
Yeah, one of the first, quote, celebrities I actually worked with was Country Joe McDonald, who was sort of
my
an old
Country
friend
Joe
of Arlo Guthrie. Yeah,
no doubt,
Country Joe and the Fish.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Remember those.
So, yippee, we're all going to die.
And it's 1, 2, 3.
What are we fighting for?
Yeah, so
let's just not let the politicians do it.
Yeah. But Country Joe was an interesting guy, and I actually ran a vending tent for him in Cedar Rapids, Iowa about, I don't know, 10 years ago now.
Huh.
So,
are you still in touch with him at all? Or?
Yeah, every now and then. If you look at his website, you'll see some products that I do for him.
Fantastic.
We etch some glass peace signs and 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for?
When's a good day for me to come by and drop in and just check out your store?
Gosh, the best thing to do is to call me and we'll set up a time.
Okay.
I mean,
because
I'm in and out a lot, and I haven't gotten to the point where I've hired anybody to run the store. So, you know, I've got to go unlock the doors.
So it's by appointment only, which is, I kind of like that concept. I always thought a restaurant should be run that way, by appointment only. When you know you've got people coming, then you go.
Yeah, then
it.
You cook and, you know,
that's it.
Just set the table and, you know, it's all working.
Yep. Chef's choice and see you later.
Yeah,
bye.
Yeah.
There's a place like that in Madison, Mississippi called Rocher. He has a set menu. I mean, you come in, you don't look at a menu. It's just, here's what you get tonight.
You want to eat?
Yeah, exactly. Here's it's called Chef's Choice. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. I like that. Yeah. So retail by appointment.
Absolutely. I mean, at least you know you've got somebody coming, and you don't have to wonder who's going to drift in the door. And I've always thought about my actually culinary company, chef's company, is called Reservations Only. Even though we have no reservations, we require them from you. And I always thought we'd float it that way. Kind of like what we did, John Paul, at the, God, remind me, West End Gallery in Raleigh.
Long time ago.
We had my art exhibit in a gallery downtown Raleigh. And twice a month, we'd have the Chef's Only Choice and invite people to come both for, you know, for the food and to buy the art or check out the art.
Didn't we do a show there?
We'd do a little performance to sort of set things off, yeah. I'd come out in my chef's uniform, take off the jacket, sit down by the mic and go into a little something, put it back on, walk around, make sure the food is.
You know, there's another guy around here that does something similar to that. Is a really well-known artist named Alan Montague.
You know him.
Yeah, Alan's a good friend, and Alan's really got a lot of stuff on the ball.
Why don't you twist his arm into coming on the show
sometime? I will do that. He would be glad to do it. I know he would.
Both come back on.
All right.
Sounds like fun.
Anyway, on that note, I'm going to give John Paul some time to establish his show because he's got to cut off this recording and make sure we're archived. So I'm going to sign off on the speakeasy. I want to thank Judd Patterson and Creative Concepts.
And I want to say thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Me too.
Thank you so much for coming.
And this is the speakeasy signing off. Until next time, cheers.
Once again, a chill night wind blows its gales across the sea. As the sunset casts an inflamed and rippled hue across the waters, vast distances of liquid motion stretch their infinity before me, and I have rarely felt so free. The sails are drawn for a night of rest. Where I go from here, the sea knows best. As the veils of night descend upon me, the moon emits its silvery canvas against a spectacle of aquatic celebration, as is only seen by night. The stars are scattered worlds of light against an opaque sky, and the nightfall is a constant whisper of the mysteries around me. Truly, all description would defy the beauty I choose herein to proclaim. Yet still, though encompassed by more wonder than many a man has e'er freed his soul to admire, my thoughts are adrift with the song of my heart, and the song of my heart with the voice of my soul. Adrift, 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 drifting ever back to you.